Welcome back to the program. You know, our recent presidential campaign reignited many aspects of the 60s, most specifically those that opposed the war in Vietnam and thought that radical and even sometimes violent means had to be used to end the conflict. The debate took us into the heart of darkness of a controversial period in our anti-war history and reminded us that judging without the context of the times is a fool's errand. Today we're going to go back to that period, to the activities of Students for Democratic Society, to the occupation of Columbia University, and to the birth of the Weather Underground, with a man who lived every second of that history. My guest Mark Rudd was one of the leaders of that time and has spent the past 40 years thinking about and analyzing his decisions during that period. Today he writes about them in his new memoir, Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. It's just published by William Morrow. Mark Rudd, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for having me.
Is it possible to truly understand, particularly for young people, to understand, and I know you spend a lot of time as a teacher and talking to young people and young organizers today, to understand what went on in that period without the context of a much broader sense of what was going on, not only in the country with regard to Vietnam and civil rights and the Cold War, but also what was going on around the world in terms of the revolutionary forces that were at play?
That, you probably put your finger on the single biggest problem. I don't know if you saw the, if you've seen the movie The Weather Underground, came out in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
About 40% of that movie is context, stock footage, you know, shots of Vietnamese major killing the guy, right, a Viet Cong suspect, right in front of the camera. I mean, the extent to which our thinking was determined by what was going on the other side of the world, and also in places like Cuba and in Latin America and in Africa. It's something that it's difficult to recreate, but I think necessary. The idea that there was world revolution taking place.
Right, and in fact, you spent time in Cuba. You spent time with Che Guevara, understanding kind of his theories, what he was doing, and tried to import some of those ideas back home.
The total amount of time that I was in Cuba was, I believe, 3 weeks in the beginning of 1968. But what kind of opened up to me was the notion of world revolution. It was after Che Guevara actually had died, and he had been killed by the Bolivian army in Bolivia in October of 67. So this was some months after. But Cuba was alive with the idea of defeating U.S. imperialism. That was what they felt they were doing, and they had this ethic of allying with and working in solidarity with the people around the world who were in revolt, such as the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
It was very heady moment to be 20 years old and to think that I might be a part of the world revolution.
And there was also a sense of action. I mean, you talk about the FOCO theory and some of Che Guevara's ideas, that it really wasn't about talking, that there was an obligation in these revolutionary times to act.
Absolutely. There was a slogan that I thought came from Che Guevara, and I have that in my book, but a friend told me it actually came from Fidel. There was a slogan that said, "The duty of every revolutionary is to make the revolution." And the way I interpret it was, you don't talk about it, you do it. You mentioned the FOCO theory. I have to tell you, you're the first interviewer that I've talked with who's picked up on that. There was a theory in the world. It probably emanated from Fidel and Che, that a small group of armed revolutionaries could spark a revolution by picking up arms, and that's what we here wanted to help out. So that's what we did.
And that idea really was a core principle, it seems, in the activities that SDS was engaged in, and that you took one step further or several steps further with respect to the Weather Underground.
Actually, not SDS. SDS, Students for Democratic Society, was a very broad and large organization on about 400 campuses. And the idea of SDS was to engage in educational activities, local struggles around the war in Vietnam, but also around student issues, in order to build the movement. And I actually differentiate in my book between SDS, which was a much larger grouping, 100,000 people at least, and the Weathermen. The Weathermen was a very small group, maybe within SDS, maybe 500 max.
Much was made at the time of the splits that started to exist within the anti-war movement, those that wanted peaceful protests, those that wanted more violent action. Talk a little about that, Mark.
Well, the theory was, this came out of Columbia in 1968, Columbia University, that our theory was that the more militant we were, the more we were expressing our opposition to the war, the more people would join. And it seemed to be what happened at Columbia, although in retrospect I have a different analysis of that. Columbia 1968 was the largest student uprising up to that point. And we wanted to create it as it became a model. But we understood it to be the result of our militancy. So what we did was we took this tactic and raised it to the level of a strategy, which is a very fundamental mistake that we made. And I that's where I think things started going wrong. And the book is not a heroic book, because essentially I talk about an arc going from, in my story, going from good organizing to bad organizing, with this emphasis on militancy, and then going to worse with the violence. We carried it through to a kind of a logical end. A friend of mine calls it thinking yourself into a corner.
And what were the forces that were at play, because again it comes back to this idea of context, that drove the thinking, that drove the tactic and ultimately the strategy towards more violent means?
Well, I think at some kind of theoretical level we had this FOCO theory, but I think that underlying it was a kind of an emotional, somewhat irrational reaction, but to a very real phenomenon. The United States was engaged in murdering millions of people in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam was a war of choice. It was not defense on the part of the United States. It was aggression, and we were heartsick over it. So if you look at the rise of violence, which was really a small part of the anti-war movement, but if you look at the rise of violence, it completely mirrored the violence in Vietnam. The high point in Vietnam was 1968 and 69 especially. The United States was bombing every single two-story building and above in North Vietnam. The extent of the violence was so great that I think it got to us. It got to us emotionally, and we were sick over it. We were grieving, and we said, this has got to stop. So it was kind of a painful emotional response to all this violence. It got to us.
Talk a little bit about the protest at Columbia, this large event, which became iconic in its time and arguably still is.
Well, again, context, very important. There had been four or 5 years of organizing, 3 years for me at Columbia. But the spring of 1968, bam, 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 three events took place in a matter of a couple of months. The Tet Offensive in Vietnam, which was a shock to most Americans because it showed that the war couldn't be won. And then Lyndon Johnson abdicating. He said, "I will not run," on March 31st, basically saying that the party, the Democratic Party, and the country was so split over the war. And then April 4th, 4 days later, Martin Luther King assassinated in Memphis. I mean, the country was just reeling with the war and with racism, and we had this very minor protest about discipline actions, but the underlying issues at Columbia had to do with the university's involvement with the war in the form of research for the Defense Department, and also the university's expansion into the Harlem neighborhood next door to Columbia. So these two issues symbolized the war and racism, and a small demonstration just blew up. Black students got involved for the first time. Very, very tiny minority at Columbia. It was black students are less than 1%, but and this in a university adjacent to the largest black ghetto in the United States, Harlem. Mm-hmm. There was nothing scripted. It was all ad hoc. But within a day, five buildings were occupied at Columbia, and we held them for about 6 days. And then the administration called in the police, and it was a very, very brutal police riot, the bust was, mm-hmm. In which hundreds were injured, and well over 600 were arrested. There must have been over 1,000 people in the buildings. Then it grew into a strike, and the entire university was on strike. So it was the largest student protest confrontation up to its time.
The overreaction by the police, to what extent did that feed into the, and I think you talk about it as a sense of despair that people were feeling about what was being done?
Yes, it kind of fed a feeling of war. We are at war. The police probably, I've never had a chance to talk with a cop about it, but my guess is that the police were angry at us because we were anti-war, but also angry at us because we were privileged, because we were middle class, upper middle class, white kids mostly, who were privileged to go to Columbia, and these were working class cops, mostly all white, who hated us. And also for our anti-war, anti-racist views, and they attacked it. They attacked us quite brutally. That fed the sense of despair and the sense of being at war.
Mm-hmm. The government was very quick to label you as terrorists and as criminals. Talk about the reaction to that. Your reaction to that.
Well, I think. It kind of drove us to an edge where we said, "Yeah, screw you! You know, you're the ones who have been supporting the war." Talking about the media, and the government and the police have been brutal and supporting the war. So, screw you! Anything goes, you know. And I think that we adopted for a brief period, maybe about 6 months, a kind of a politics of, I call it the politics of transgression, where we became, as one person put it, the incubation of your mother's nightmare. and the irony of it all was, I was just a nice Jewish boy from the suburbs, you know.
Right. And one of the things you talk about is that certainly in the 40 years that you had a chance to reflect on this, that you now see that inherently so much of it never really works.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the only thing that worked was the mass organizing, education, especially at Columbia, that made for this campus-wide understanding of the war and of racism and of people making a choice to join in the struggle. Then after that, nothing worked. And the more transgressive we got, the worse it got. So I often say, well, it's a story of good organizing followed by bad organizing, followed by worse organizing. And it took me years to understand it. I was lucky in that, I was a fugitive for seven years,
right.
And then after I turned myself in, most of the charges had been dropped because of government illegality. And then I just went to work, and I became a math instructor at community college, and I put all this behind me and carried on with my life, so to speak. But the book is a lot an attempt to understand what happened, and also to forgive myself these terrible choices that I made.
The fact that it was that all this activity was recently brought up again and put in the context of terrorism. Talk about your reaction to that.
Oh, you're talking about Bill Ayers.
About Bill Ayers, right.
Yeah, the charge by the McCain campaign, and actually before that, the Hillary Clinton campaign, that Bill Ayers was palling around with a terrorist. Well, I had a slightly different reaction from Bill's, which was I accepted the term terrorist. I think there was a moment when we did go off the edge, and we then pulled back from it. That had to do with a bombing that went awry, and three of our own people died. We were targeting civilians, which is a common definition of terrorism. But I kept thinking that whole time, what kind of terrorism is it to drop bombs on villages from 10,000 feet in the air, to drop 1,000-pound bombs? I've come around to believe that all violence is terrorism, even state-sanctioned violence in the form of war. John McCain, in my way of thinking, was a terrorist, even though the government put him in the seat of a Phantom jet or whatever he flew. He was a mass murderer. So the Weather Underground killed three people, our own. That we were fortunate. We didn't kill anybody else. The John McCain, we have no accounting of how many people he murdered by dropping bombs on Vietnamese villages. So I'll accept the term terrorism, and I would like John McCain and Henry Kissinger and all the other people who designed the war and who carried it out to look at their own actions too.
How did the anti-war protests against the Iraq War trigger some of these old thoughts and old ideas in you?
Well, you know, every time the United States starts a war, I go through a period of depression. I mean, that happened in the 80s when the United States attacked Central America with surrogate troops. But no, I have my own form of PTSD where I go through a period of depression, and then I get going and oppose the try to organize, try to get as many people together as possible to oppose the violence. And I would say that Vietnam was the defining event in my life, and I see it come back again and again and again. I think that we need to turn away from this system of war that we have, and to look for solutions such as diplomacy and international law.
Is there ever a justification for war, in your view?
No. No. War, especially now with the so-called collateral damage of the civilians, the weapons of mass destruction, the bombs that go up to 10,000 pounds, the potential for a nuclear threat. No, I think that in some theoretical sense, yes, there may be self-defense, but the United States has no enemies that are comparable to us and that there are, for example, police methods for dealing with terrorism rather than declaring war. The Europeans have known this for a long time, and they've been pretty successful at isolating terrorists rather than declaring war. I believe that we have a rush to war.
Going back to that 1968 period, what role did the Cold War mentality and the issue of communism, what role did that play in the thinking of the anti-war movement?
Well, the anti-war movement, the great breakthrough of the early 60s, was to realize that the Cold War and anti-communism was a way of moving toward war. It was building up the enemy as a great threat, so that there would be a constant buildup of construction of weapons and placing bases and aircraft carriers all around the world, and fighting surrogate wars, which is what Vietnam was. So the great breakthrough was to realize that anti-communism was actually a method of justifying the buildup and the actual carrying out of war. The Soviet Union was never a threat. It could have been isolated in many different ways. It was built up, or rather the fear of the Soviet Union was built up by the war party, the CIA and the government itself, our government, in order to justify the arms buildup. No, I consider the Cold War period to have been psychotic, and the buildup of nuclear weapons to be absolute, total irrationality and a threat to the existence of the planet. Probably hundreds of years from now, people will think of it as a time of total psychosis. One of the psychoses, incidentally, is the idea of going to Vietnam and murdering 3 to 5 million people, and thinking that it was somehow doing some good on the planet.
When you look back at the anti-war movement, all aspects of it, to what extent do you think that it did good in terms of bringing a quicker end to the war?
Well, had there not been an anti-war movement, it's possible the United States would still be in Vietnam, still fighting, because the Vietnamese were not going to go anywhere. It's not that easy. In fact, it was impossible for the United States to conquer Vietnam. It's probably impossible for the United States to conquer Iraq. The Vietnamese were not going anywhere. The Iraqis are not going anywhere. And they're not going to submit to American occupation. But had there not been an anti-war movement, we might still be fighting. No, I think the anti-war movement played a huge role in ending the war, and that was a great event in American history when the people of this country stood up and said no. I consider it the highest moment of American democracy.
And within that, do you think that the violent aspects of the anti-war movement were helpful?
No, absolutely not. I think that the violence split the anti-war movement into a big argument over that particular tactic, but even worse, it played into the hands of the pro-war party, the government, and the FBI, the repressive police apparatus, and it probably convinced a certain number of people not to join the anti-war movement. No, I think that the small amount of violence we did by a small number of people, it was quite detrimental.
Talk about the explosion on West 11th Street. What happened? And that was the event that ultimately sent you underground.
Yes, and it was also the event that also turned me away from the underground. It was probably the high point of our craziness, where we thought, well, that only we, few small band of kids, understood the war and understood the world revolution. Nobody else could understand it, and that all white Americans and all civilian Americans who acquiesced to this monstrosity are the enemy. And the group in the townhouse was planning a a bombing of a non-commissioned officer's dance at Fort Dix using homemade pipe bombs with nails in it. It was a horrible thing. And they were in a house owned by the father of one of the members of the group, and accidentally some wires got crossed while making the bomb, and three bombs, and they went off and killed three of our own people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a nightmare. It was a tragedy, but it was probably lucky compared to. What we might have done, and the effect of what we might have done, it probably would have set back the anti-war movement by years. It's a very horrible, arrogant thing, and it took me years to understand this, and years of shame. But I'm 60 years old now, 61, and I can talk about it in public.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk to young people about it today, what do you tell them?
I tell them, don't do that kind of crap. I tell them that the goal is always to build a mass movement and that it's possible. I try to tell them that it happened. We actually had a mass movement. We had many mass movements in this country. In my lifetime, the civil rights movement changed so much in this country, and the black freedom movement subsequent, the women's movement, the gay rights movement, the disability rights movement. You can go on and on. The labor movement. I was alive as a child for the tail end of the labor movement, and how much it accomplished. The society we have now, to a large extent, the better parts of society are a result of mass movements. And I tell people, well, it happened. It actually happened. I was part of this mass movement. And it could happen again. And don't lose faith.
Mark Rudd, the book is Underground, My Life with SDS and the Weathermen. Mark, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, thank you for inviting me. And thank you, and good luck in your work.
My pleasure.